and try to explain why her views are wrong or hurtful. Maybe we try to get to the bottom of her views, find their root cause, and work to change her mind. Maybe we explain that while she may think she's just expressing an opinion or making a joke, her words risk damaging our relationship with her, and that remaining silent as she says these things threatens our own sense of integrity. But no matter what we do, we keep two conflicting thoughts in our minds at the same time. I love this person is causing me anguish. We treat those thoughts with equal weight, and we hope the person in question will do the same. Unsurprisingly, Snyder loses again. There's a PS to this discussion. The Washington football team finally changed their name. In the summer of 2020, as the entire country wrestled with police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement put racial injustice front and center, Snyder finally decided to join the rest of us here in the 21st century and agreed that the nickname was no longer appropriate. Of all the ways we can become better people, dragged kicking and screaming isn't ideal, but all right, it's better than nothing. It feels worth mentioning that not long after the decision to change the name, a Washington Post piece exposed a disturbing pattern of sexual harassment committed by executives in the team's front office that turned into a full-blown PR nightmare. I'm sure that's just a coincidence, though. I prefer to focus not on the winding path of doofusness that brought us here, but on the relief and happiness of the indigenous people and their allies who earned the win in this hard-fought battle. It hammers home what we've been saying about trying. Snyder shouted only a few years ago that he would never, in all caps, change the name of his team. But a bunch of people kept trying. They kept lobbying and lightly shaming him and making their case, and little by little, the Overton window shifted. Other teams changed their names, social justice crept forward, and finally, the window's range included something that was once unthinkable. This was a hard one. These are all hard ones. It can wear us out thinking about these problems, especially when we come armed with 2,400 years of philosophical theory and still can't find a definitive solution. In moments like this, a tempting voice calls out to us. Stop caring. Life is so much easier when you don't try so hard to be good, especially given that it sometimes feels impossible. I mean, we're just little flecks of dust on a tiny rock in outer space. Does anything we do even matter? So, does it?
Chapter 11. Making ethical decisions is hard. Can we just not make them?
You've probably heard the term existentialism, and chances are that when you heard it, it was being used incorrectly. Any literature that's bleak or deals with death or is vaguely European runs the risk of being labeled existentialist, and it's usually not. Existential is one of those fancy words that people like to use when the word they really mean is much simpler.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
Kafkaesque,
what they mean is,
eerie.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
surrealist,
what they mean is,
weird looking.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
ironic,
what they really mean is,
annoying.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
existential,
what they mean is,
dark, sad, and bleak.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
Freudian,
what they mean is,
penis related.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
postmodern,
what they mean is,
recent.
When people who want to sound fancy say,
Orwellian,
what they really mean is,
I got banned from Twitter for being racist.
I suppose we can't really blame people for using the word incorrectly because existentialist writing, most closely associated with a philosophical and literary movement in mid-20th century France, is famously difficult to understand. But buried in its texts, under 1,000 layers of Gaulois smoke and Gallic angst, is a new angle on ethical decision-making that sidesteps most of what we've discussed so far and urges us to be good people in a dramatic and, yes, kind of bleak way. Jean-Paul Sartre, famous optimist. Existentialism, in a hilariously reductive nutshell, believes the following. Human existence is absurd. There is no higher power or deity or meaning to be found beyond the fact of that existence, and this condition fills us with dread and anxiety. The movement's overall goal, although the details vary from writer to writer, was to make sense of what we can do in the face of that absurdity, dread, and anxiety. Even at its height, existentialism was largely misunderstood and criticized. On October 29, 1945, French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre attempted to set the record straight, giving a speech entitled Existentialism is a Humanism in Paris. The title itself was meant to surprise people. A humanism? This dude is claiming that his philosophy is optimistic and pro-people? We're talking about Jean-Paul Sartre, one of the most famously grim people in history. He named his cat Nothing. It's not that he didn't give his cat a name. It's that the name he gave his cat was Nothing. He wrote books called Nausea and Being and Nothingness. I mean, imagine writing a book called Being and Nothingness and then asking, why does everybody think I'm depressing? Sartre was trying to dispel misunderstandings about existentialism. Essentially, he wanted people to stop using the term wrong.
Indeed, the word is being so loosely applied to so many things that it has come to mean nothing at all.
He apparently spoke without notes of any kind, which is astounding, and he comes across like a lawyer making a closing argument on behalf of his client. He's literally defensive, but for good reason. His existentialist writings had made everyone mad at him. As Arlette El-Kaim Sartre, his adopted daughter and sometime translator, writes in the preface to the 1996 French edition,
Christians chastised Sartre, not only for his atheism, but for being a materialist, while communists reproached him for not being one. In many people's minds, Sartre was becoming the anti-humanist par excellence. He demoralized the French at a time when France, lying in ruins, most needed hope.
In a very short time, really between 1943 and 1945, Sartre had managed to piss off communists, atheists, and artists, even while being an atheistic novelist who wrote for underground communist journals. I mean, that's hard to do. This existentialism is powerful stuff. The religious objection to existentialism doesn't take much explanation. Sartre famously denies the presence of any omnipotent God that watches over us or judges our actions. To Sartre, we're born out of nothingness, poof, and then it's entirely up to us what we are and do, and then we die, poof, and that's it. Nothing guides us. We're not following any playbook from religion or spirituality or anything. All we have, and all we ultimately are, is the choices we make while we're alive. The belief that we exist before there's any meaning attached to our lives is a condition Sartre calls subjectivity, and he explains it by saying, existence precedes essence. The most important conclusion it leads him to is this. If there's no giant structure that fills the world with any kind of meaning before or after we exist, then, quote, man is responsible for what he is.
Man first exists. He materializes in the world, encounters himself, and only afterwards defines himself. If man, as existentialists conceive of him, cannot be defined, it is because, to begin with, he is nothing. He will not be anything until later. And then he will be what he makes of himself.
For anyone brought up in one of the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, life without God is like a baseball game with no umps. No one is keeping score or enforcing rules, so anything goes. As Dostoevsky famously wrote, if God does not exist, everything is permissible. He actually didn't write that at all. The real quote is much longer and more intricate, but that pithy version is the one that you see all the time. It's another play-it-again-Sam kind of a deal. More than a century later, Kurt Vonnegut would update and rephrase this sentiment in a way that I find much more fun. He said, quote, "I'm telling you, we are here on Earth to fart around and don't let anybody ever tell you any different." If you remove God from the equation, and thus any kind of grand design for humanity, then we're all just a bunch of dodos wandering around the planet accountable to nothing but ourselves. And that's exactly what Sartre believed. In fact, it's the very guts of his entire philosophy. Existentialism is a little like when your parents yelled at you when you were 15 because you did something stupid, and they said, "You're a grown-up, you're responsible for your actions." Except in this case, it's a French philosopher yelling at you, and his conclusions deny the existence of God. For Sartre, life with no God to create systemic order for humanity may indeed be disturbing, but it's also freeing. Without commandments we have to follow, or meaning to be found in religion, or national identity, or your parents being dentists and demanding that you become a dentist too, or anything else, we are truly free, in like a big-picture, eagle-eye view of everything kind of a way, to choose what we are. Signs or omens exist only because we choose to see them, and we should never make a decision based on one. Or, if we do, we should recognize that the sign isn't making the decision. We are simply choosing to interpret the sign in a way that points to our decision. Religious instruction, education, family traditions, a magic eight ball, they're all equally bad crutches to rely on when we face a choice. Every person, whether Peruvian or Mongolian, a pauper or third in line for the Danish throne, is perfectly and completely free to make whatever choices she wants. But, and this is kind of tricky, when we make our choices, we're actually making them for all people. Sartre, of course, used men and not people. Wrap your head around that for a second. When we choose to do things, says Sartre, we're creating an image of a person as they should be, which can then be viewed and followed by everyone else. Here Sartre weirdly converges with Kant because he wants us to ask ourselves, what would happen if everyone did what I am doing? He wants us to determine our own morality, but then also model that morality for everyone else. Now, this might seem like a contradiction. There's no God, no meaning to the universe, no guidebook to follow. Everyone can make whatever choices he wants. But also, those choices should be a model for everyone else? Well, then, we might ask, wouldn't thinking of yourself as a model for others be in conflict with the idea that everyone makes choices for herself, not following any external guide or rulebook? But don't worry, there's a good reason that this seems like a contradiction. It's a contradiction. Honestly, it's a little unclear how Sartre maintains all of these ideas simultaneously, or even why he would want to. He did sympathize with the communists in post-war Europe, so maybe his political beliefs seeped in here a little bit as he tried to find a way that humans were connected to each other. All I know is people have been writing about this contradiction for 70 years, so the odds that I untangle it in this paragraph are slim. Now, if you're thinking, hey, you just told me there's no God and no meaning to our existence and that all we have are our choices, and now you're telling me I have to make choices that model behavior for all of humanity, I kind of have a stomach ache here, man. Well, yeah, that's exactly the point. In fact, Sartre acknowledges that this particular human condition fills us with anguish. Quote, "the kind experienced by all who have borne responsibilities," end quote. He knows how hard it is to be a human being on Earth under the circumstances he describes, and he refuses to let us off the hook. Life is anguish. Welcome to existentialism. And yet, for all the anguish it entails, Sartre believed about existentialism that, quote, "no doctrine is more optimistic," end quote. The way Sartre puts it in his trademark, "everything I say is kind of terrifying even when I'm trying to reassure you" style is this, quote, "man is condemned to be free," end quote. We have no crutches or reasons to do whatever we choose to do except that we have chosen to do them. And I know what you're thinking, what if I just don't choose anything? Sorry, no go. If I decide not to choose, he says, that still constitutes a choice. Or, in the words of Canadian rock power trio Rush in their song Free Will,
if you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice.
I bet you didn't think when you bought this book on philosophy and got to the chapter on existentialism you were going to get a Rush lyric thrown at you, huh? Well, too bad. It happened. And I bet you really didn't think that that Rush lyric was going to be actually read by legendary Rush frontman Geddy Lee, huh? But too bad. That also happened. The optimistic thing about this condition, for Sartre, is that, quote, man's destiny lies within himself, end quote. If we embrace the idea that all we are is our choices, we are forced to freely make any choice we want, whenever we want. We have no other option. There's no other way out of this anguish-filled mess. All of which makes existentialists super fun at parties. Here's a true story. Our own Todd May went through a hardcore existentialism phase in college, and he responded to everyone who asked him a question by saying this.
I am choosing to...
whatever his answer was. So someone would say, there's a party tonight in my dorm. You want to go? And Todd would reply,
I am choosing to not go to your party.
Todd has been married for many years and has three grown children, and when I heard that story, I wondered how any of that was remotely possible. In his speech from 1945, Sartre gives the example of a former student, a young man who lived with his mother. The man's father had been a Nazi collaborator, which shamed the mother, and the man's older brother had already been killed in the war. He had to decide whether to go off and join the freedom fighters in England, trying to avenge the death of his brother, or stay and care for his mother, who had already lost so much. Now, the guy knew he might be killed long before he arrived in England, but he also knew that staying home meant not fighting for the cause he believed in or avenging his brother's death. It was a real World War II flavored pickle. Sartre's point is that nothing can help the young man make his choice. There's no oracle he can consult, no Kantian rule or moral theory or anything else that addresses this fraught decision. There is only his decision, and his decision is just his decision, whatever it is. So he should make it and own it instead of relying on the Bible or reading J.S. Mill or consulting a psychic at a carnival. So here we are, 8 hours deep in this audiobook, having learned all about deontology and utilitarianism and contractualism and virtue ethics and a bunch of other stuff, and along comes a morose Frenchman to tell us that there's no God and people define themselves through action alone, and we have to just make decisions with no guidance except the essential anguish of our own existence or something. He's telling us that Kant and Bentham and Scanlon and Aristotle are about as helpful to our moral lives as a coin flip. So should we listen to him and just junk all these other theories? Albert Camus, the non-existentialist existentialist. Before we even entertain that notion, we should talk about the other great French existentialist, Albert Camus. Sartre and Camus were contemporary French philosophers who both won the Nobel Prize in Literature, but they also had some key differences. For one thing, Camus accepted his Nobel Prize while Sartre turned his down, which is super punk rock and extremely French. Camus had already died by the time Sartre won and turned down the prize, but I bet if he'd been alive, he would have been annoyed that he didn't have the idea to do that first. Camus' existentialist musings are even more stripped down and intense than Sartre's. As I mentioned earlier, Sartre did some kind of contradictory work to make his philosophy compatible with communist political movements in post-war France. Camus didn't care about that. Sartre thought we should perform actions that could serve as models for others. Camus didn't care about that either. His existentialism is like a balsamic reduction of Sartre's. It's sharper and more intense and more potent. In fact, Camus actually claimed repeatedly that he wasn't an existentialist. But take a second and do an image search for Albert Camus. I mean, come on. You're telling me that guy isn't an existentialist? Also, not that this matters, but what a looker, am I right? It's funny to think of philosophers as sexy, but you gotta give it up. Camus was a stone-cold hottie. Camus broke down his version of existentialism, which again he denied he was, blah, 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 this way. Humans desire meaning from the universe, but the universe is cold and indifferent, and it denies us that meaning. In fact, nothing means anything, really, or at least nothing is more meaningful than anything else. So we're just little specks of nothingness on a big dumb rock floating in space, desperately searching for something that we will never find. And thus, the human condition is fundamentally absurd.
I said that the world is absurd, but what is absurd is the confrontation of this irrational and the wild longing for clarity whose call echoes in the human heart.
By the way, in translation, Camus uses the word irrational as a noun, and it refers to the unknowable meaning of things in the universe.
The absurd depends as much on man as on the world. For the moment, it is all that links them together. It binds them one to the other as only hatred can weld two creatures together. This is all I can discern clearly in this measureless universe where my adventure takes place.
Okay, great. So then, what do we do? How do we deal with this fundamental absurdity? Well, Camus says we have three choices. Number one, we can kill ourselves. This seems, you know, less than ideal. To be clear, Camus doesn't say we should commit suicide. He just says that it's technically a way out of the absurdity of longing for meaning in a meaningless universe because it eliminates half of the equation, the person who desires that meaning. Number two, we can embrace some kind of structure, religion, family, work, anything, and find meaning in that. It's better than suicide, right? Well, for Camus, actually, no, or barely. He refers to this process of imbuing something with meaning as, quote, philosophical suicide, end quote. It's an attempt to get rid of the other half of the absurd equation, the cold, indifferent, meaningless universe, by manufacturing meaning that we can then cling to. But to create meaning out of any societal structure is to deny the inescapable fact that we're just little specks of nothingness on a big dumb rock floating in space, searching for meaning in a cold and indifferent universe that will never provide it. And for him, that's ultimately harmful.
The doctrines that explain everything to me?
That is, the structures that could theoretically offer him some kind of meaning.
Also debilitate me at the same time.
Okay, so what's option number three? Option number three is, we can acknowledge the fundamental absurdity of the human condition and just kind of exist within it. I said that in kind of a fun, upbeat way to try to hide how bleak a sentence that is. But for Camus, that's the only real answer.
I do not know whether this world has a meaning that transcends it. But I know that I do not know that meaning and that it is impossible for me just now to know it. These two certainties, my appetite for the absolute and for unity, and the impossibility of reducing this world to a rational and reasonable principle, I also know that I cannot reconcile them.
The only way to cope with our desire for meaning inside an empty, pointless universe is to recognize how absurd it is that we exist in an empty, pointless universe and still desire meaning. So he wants us to stand in the middle of this hurricane of absurdity, neither denying it nor allowing it to defeat us. In the myth of Sisyphus, Camus discusses the famous fable wherein Sisyphus is condemned to roll a heavy rock up a hill, after which the rock rolls back down the hill, whereupon he has to descend and then roll it back up the hill forever. He's been assigned this eternal fate because he pissed off the gods in a bunch of different ways, so they gave him an absurd, repetitive task that stretches out infinitely. But Camus saw it differently. So Sisyphus has to complete this same ridiculous task over and over forever. So what? Quote, the workman of today, he points out, works every day in his life at the same tasks, and this fate is no less absurd, end quote. And in the case of Sisyphus, quote, his fate belongs to him. His rock is his thing, end quote. Camus says that Sisyphus's existence was made deliberately and inexorably absurd, which means it's all Sisyphus can think about, and thus he understands how absurd it is, and therefore it frees him from the distracting illusion of meaning. There is only this singular task, this one struggle. Camus concludes, in a sentence that has been rocking the worlds of college freshmen for 70 years, one must imagine Sisyphus happy. So with Sartre and Camus, we have a couple of new theoretical approaches to ethics which have to do with the idea of absolute radical freedom. Can they somehow help us in our quest to become better people? We had no choice. Sartre's critics offered a pretty decent comeback, which recalls the question that I imagine some of you may have had at the beginning of this book. Who the hell are you to judge me? If there is no higher power, how can it be that any individual has any authority to say others should do what he does? Sartre's response was to say that we make our choices individually, but, quote, in the presence of others, end quote. So if we determine that someone is relying on religion or some other structure as a reason for making a choice, she screwed up. He calls such a reliance on external factors or structures an error, and suggests that we should announce it as such. It's not exactly an entire ethical system, but Sartre is certainly concerned with what we do and why we do it. Similarly, if our friend asks us what we think of her ugly shirt and we look to Camus for advice, and he smiles insouciantly and says, "You should simply stand naked within the incongruous farce of existence," well, that's maybe not super helpful. But that doesn't mean it has nothing to offer us in our quest to be good. The complete freedom that existentialists shove down our throats, this insistence that we can't defend our choices using any external structure, keeps us from using those structures as a crutch. Let's imagine we're in one of those really weird ethical tangles where there's no easy answer. Our friend Sue is furious with our other friend Gina because Gina has been spreading rumors about Sue cheating on her boyfriend. When Sue vents to us, we tell her we're on her side because Gina tends to do stuff like this. I mean, you know Gina, she's a mess. Then later, totally coincidentally, Gina calls and asks if we want to use her lake house for the weekend because she has to go take care of her ailing mother. Now, we know that doing this will annoy Sue. "How could you accept her offer when she's being so awful to me?" she'll likely say. I mean, you know Sue. She has a bit of a martyr complex. But on the other hand, we have nothing to do with this beef, really, and it kind of sounds relaxing to sit by a lake all day. And also, Gina is paying us back for that time last year that we picked her up from the airport, and saying no would require us to either A, tell her that we're saying no because of her beef with Sue, or else B, lie to her, and we read in a book somewhere that Kant told us we're never supposed to lie, and C, Gina actually told us we'd be doing her a favor by looking after her house, and she's already stressed about her ailing mother, and so on. These complex decisions arise all the time. They contain 50 different considerations and ethical vectors and loyalty tests. And sometimes, even if we're determined to be good little utilitarians or virtue seekers or deontological maxim obeyers, it can be impossible to make sense of all of it. And when that happens, we're tempted to look for something solid to hang on to, a reason that justifies what we're going to do, as though that were really the only possible choice. Reasons make us feel better because they reframe our choices as inevitable, thus absolving us of responsibility. We had no choice but to accept Gina's offer because not doing so would be rude, or we had no choice but to reject it because of our friendship with Sue. The existentialists are there to remind us it's always our choice. For all of its confusing French linguistic gymnastics, there's a simplicity to Sartre's existentialism. We choose to act, and the choices are ours and ours alone. And there's a comfort, sometimes, in Camus' existentialism. Just being human often feels ridiculous, and true happiness may come from just accepting that ridiculousness as inescapable. Both men also encourage us not to dwell on our mistakes. Okay, we blew it. Next time, don't. If Aristotle tells us to keep trying different things in order to find that bullseye of virtue, an existentialist says, keep making choices. Because choices are all we have in our absurd, meaningless universe. Not all existentialists were French. Soren Kierkegaard was Danish, and people often call some of the great 19th century Russian novelists, like Dostoevsky, existentialists. But again, I mean, come on. It's so French. However, Despite Sartre thinking that his existentialism is humanistic, or how liberating Camus' existentialism might be for the mythical Sisyphus, it can be pretty unforgiving for real people. Let's now imagine a low-income woman in rural Alaska who wrenches her knee. A doctor prescribes her absurdly powerful opioids because he's corrupt and has a side deal with a pharmaceutical company to sell as much OxyContin as he can. She then becomes addicted to the opioids. She can't afford her habit, and eventually she steals money from a gas station to pay the corrupt doctor. Is she a thief? Well, Sartre would say, yes, she made that choice. It's her choice and hers alone, etc., etc. But exhortations like, we are responsible for our decisions, are not exactly helpful when a diabolical pharma company has invented a powerful drug and lied about its addictive qualities, and then a corrupt doctor has gotten you addicted to that drug. Todd notes here that Sartre would also say that addiction is a choice, and Mike notes that Sartre needs to cool it a little. Saying that all we are is our choices ignores the fact that sometimes choices are made for us. People don't choose to be put in many situations that they're in. They're just in them. And then those situations often force them to make other choices that in a more forgiving or at least neutral world, they wouldn't make. We'll deal with this in greater detail in the next chapter, but it's relevant here. The choices we make may be our own, but the life into which we're born and many of the events that befall us after that are things we often have little or no control over. Here's a note from Todd to ward off some protests from the pro-Sartre crowd.
Sartre sort of kind of recognized at this point obliquely in his concept of despair, which says, quote, we must limit ourselves to reckoning only with those things that depend on our will or on the set of probabilities that enable action. Whenever we desire something, there are always elements of probability, end quote. But come on, Sartre. It's poverty we're talking about, not blackjack.
We've now heard a large number of theories spanning dozens of centuries, all of which have given us reasons to care about whether what we're doing is good and playbooks for how we might try to be better. But there's one essential aspect of the human condition that none of them really deals with: context. Few of these philosophies grapple with the plain fact that moral choices are a lot harder for some of us than they are for others, depending on our circumstances. I mean, how can it be that the same exact rules apply to me, Prince William, that poor woman whose doctor got her addicted to OxyContin, a South Korean dental hygienist, Cardi B, a sugarcane farmer in Guyana, and you? As we've talked about what we should do in any given situation, we've ignored that within the word we are a whole bunch of different me's, and each me describes a unique life with unique challenges and privileges, which might make the work of being good harder or easier for that me than the me who lives right next door. So, enough collective we action. Let's get specific.
Chapter 12. I gave a 27-cent tip to my barista, and now everyone's yelling at me on Twitter just because I'm a billionaire. I can't even enjoy the soft-shell crab rolls that my sushi chef made for my private dirigible trip to the Dutch Antilles. How is that fair?
The effort that we put into being ethical matters, certainly, but it also matters to what degree we can even try. To quote the great pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Xenophanes on the subject of daily existence, quote, this shit ain't easy, end quote. And the playing field isn't exactly level. There's no evidence Xenophanes ever said this, but a lot of pre-Socratic Greek philosophical writing was lost or destroyed, so, you know, he might have. We do not all have equal amounts of time and energy and money to put toward making good decisions. As our old friend Julia Annis writes,
there are very many people in the world today who live in terrible conditions of poverty and violence, for example, in the slums of large cities. which make it unreasonable to expect them to reflect on and criticize the lessons they are taught by the role models they have, people who frequently, and understandably, emphasize the importance not of the virtues, but of looking out for yourself, not getting held back by caring about others, becoming used to violence and cruelty, and worse. Most of these people fail to become virtuous because of the difficulties of their situation, not because they are not capable of it.
We may all be born with those virtue starter kits we talked about way back in Chapter 1. We all have the potential to be virtuous. But Annis points out that it shouldn't be held against people when circumstances deny them the chance to develop that potential into actual virtues. Remember how obsessed the Greeks were with teachers? Well, what happens when we can't learn from Aristotle because we don't have enough money to pay for his fancy elite academy, and the wisest man in our neighborhood is some skeevy guy who sells knockoff affliction shirts out of the back of his van? Many people in this world might want to spend their time thinking about ethics and virtue, but they have to focus instead on more pressing matters like, you know, not starving or not dying of disease or not being killed by roving gangs of paramilitary troops. How is that their fault? Kant's zero-tolerance policy is hardly better in this regard. Formulating and following universal maxims can be an impossible luxury if your life has taken a wrong turn or contains too many daily stressors to think about anything other than survival. And as for utilitarianism, well, what if we're not a trolley driver, but rather one of the construction workers, slaving away on the tracks in the hot sun for minimum wage, vaguely aware that at any moment we might get flattened because of faulty trolley brakes? How can we be held to the same ethical standard as the passenger who can ponder the correct moral response to this situation without fear of death? What if we're not Jim, that tourist who happened upon Pete holding a gun on the 10 locals, but one of the locals, and our daily lives include the Superfund variable that at any moment we might get rounded up and shot as a way for Pete to maintain his demented law and order regimen? Can we really be expected to spend the same amount of time and energy thinking about ethics as Jim, who happened upon this nightmare accidentally and after it's over will get to go back to his resort and sip a frozen daiquiri by the pool? It's a hard-knock life, and it's much harder for some people than for others. It seems unfair to demand the same level of ethical effort from an unwittingly opioid-addicted woman as we would from Jeff Bezos or me or any average citizen. But when we're considering circumstance as a factor in our ability to navigate life's myriad pitfalls, we don't even need to consider someone living under rare or extraordinary pressure. The most basic facts of existence can create wildly different living experiences for two people who otherwise may appear roughly similar. The writer John Scalzi crystallized the problem of ignoring context and privilege in a 2012 blog post titled "Straight White Male, the Lowest Difficulty Setting There Is."
Imagine life here in the U.S., or indeed pretty much anywhere in the Western world, is a massive role-playing game like World of Warcraft, except appallingly mundane, where most quests involve the acquisition of money, cell phones, and donuts, although not always at the same time. Let's call it the real world. You have installed the real world on your computer and are about to start playing, but first you go to the Settings tab to bind your keys, fiddle with your defaults, and choose the difficulty setting for the game. Got it? Okay. In the role-playing game The Real World, straight white male is the lowest difficulty setting there is. This means that the default behaviors for almost all non-player characters in the game are easier on you than they would be otherwise. The default barriers for completion of quests are lower. Your leveling up thresholds come more quickly. You automatically gain entry to some parts of the map that others have to work for. The game is easier to play automatically, and when you need help, by default, it's easier to get.
Scalzi is focused on race and gender here, not class, but I feel like you can apply his metaphor to any class structure as well. In other words, a straight, white, working-class male will be playing an easier version of the game than a gay, East Asian, working-class woman, and so on. The fundamental problem with applying the same ethical theories equally to all people is that all people aren't living equal lives. Centuries of history, socioeconomic development, racism, genderism, and coagulations of power and capital mean that two people born in roughly the same place at the same time may face very different hurdles in their lives. Again, while we may be equal in our potential for virtue, not everyone can apply the same amount of precious resources to the development of virtue. And if caring and trying are the most important aspects of ethical engagement, that means it would be silly to ask all people to care and try the same amount. There is a certain strain of modern Western socio-political thinker that aggressively admires meritocracy. Every society should be a meritocracy, argue these adherents, and we should not pass laws that favor one group of people over another for any reason. There should be no affirmative action laws for university admissions, no initiatives to gender balance workforces. The cream shall simply rise to the top. These people, usually heterosexual, rich, white men with a bookshelf full of Ayn Rand novels, conveniently forget that for a meritocracy to work, for a society to properly value and celebrate hard work and individual success, the people within the society need to start from the same point of origin. Otherwise, the cream isn't rising to the top. The people who were closest to the top already are rising to the top, and the whole concept of meritocracy crumbles to dust. What they are actually calling for, these people, is a pseudo-meritocracy that does not distinguish between the accomplishments of a man with a Mayflower last name who inherited $1 billion from his dad and those of a black woman who was born into poverty in a redlined neighborhood in a state that enforces draconian racist laws. Some people, as the old saying goes, were born on third base and think they hit a triple. It's not a meritocracy if some runners start the race 10 feet from the finish line and some are denied entry to the race because of systemic biases within the racing commission. We were all born into circumstances over which we had no control and which conferred on us certain advantages or disadvantages. I was born a healthy white dude in America in 1975 to two married, college-educated parents who never had a lot of money but lived a decent middle-class life in central Connecticut. I didn't have a say in the matter. That was just my roll of the dice. And what did that lucky roll mean for me? It meant I was born with immunity to the following societal ills: racism, sexism, ableism, misogyny, famine, poverty, low-quality, underfunded schools, war in my home country, lack of clean water, lack of medical care. America's health system leaves a lot to be desired, but I could, like, go to the dentist twice a year and get vaccinated and stuff like that. I escaped all of those booby traps, which can throttle people as they attempt to make their way in the world, through no effort of my own, just because of the random, specific embryo that I happened to grow out of. I started my life with a massive societal advantage, and when we do a general checkup of my ethical report card, it makes perfect sense to factor that in. Demanding applause for being a generally ethical person would be like me starting a marathon 25 miles in, beating someone who started at the actual starting line, and then bragging about winning. Barely beating them, probably, because I hate running so much, I'm not even sure I could commit to it for 1 mile. I have gotten to play the video game of life on the easiest possible setting, so if I make a bad choice, I have made a really bad choice. Think again of Jean Valjean in Les Misérables. He steals a loaf of bread to feed his sister's family and ends up serving 19 years in prison. But he was poor, his family was starving, and he felt like he had no choice. Now consider this. What if I, an adult television writer with plenty of money and a nice house and no cute little starving French urchins to feed, steal a loaf of bread just because? Kant would say that the two actions, Jean Valjean stealing bread and me stealing bread, are the same because both violate the same universal maxim. Sartre might agree, we both simply made a choice. But I would say that when Jean Valjean stole a loaf of bread to feed his starving family, he was courageous, valiant, self-sacrificing, and generous, whereas when I did it, I was just a rich asshole who stole a loaf of bread for no reason. My crime would be worse, The luck of the draw. Now, after the circumstances of our births put us on a course we had no choice in taking, our lives unfold in any of a billion possible ways. People born white, rich, and male in America contract debilitating diseases. People born female, bisexual, and South Asian become wealthy pop stars. Lives ebb and flow, fortunes are made, lost, or are ripped away. We're in the right or wrong place at the right or wrong time and either benefit or suffer. Our friends and family demand more or less from us. Recognize again, however, that some of us are far more likely to benefit by being in the right place at the right time, like a fancy dining club at the moment when a titan of industry is looking for a new executive vice president of international development. That's obviously not a time and place that most people would have the ability to take advantage of. In short, even if we start our journeys with a certain level of ease or difficulty, we're still somewhat at the mercy of chance. A lot of life, before we're born and after, is just luck, good or bad. So we ought to understand how exactly that luck affects us and our ability to be good. Some years ago, a social scientist named Robert Frank was playing tennis with a friend, and he had a massive heart attack. His friend dialed 911, and the dispatcher called for an ambulance. Emergency vehicles were usually sent from a location miles away and would have taken 30 to 40 minutes to get to those tennis courts. But as it happened, two ambulances had just reported to the scenes of two different car accidents only 1 minute from where Frank was lying motionless. One of those ambulances was able to peel away, get to Frank immediately, and save his life. Frank later learned that he had suffered from something called sudden cardiac death, a pretty goddamn intense-sounding medical condition that is 98% fatal, and the few who do survive it often have intense and lasting side effects, which he did not. When Frank woke up and learned what had happened, he had a lovely reaction. From that moment on, he thought, everything that happened in his life was due directly to good luck. Without the random good fortune of the nearby ambulance, he would have had no more moments of any kind, which means that everything he experienced afterward was fruit from that lucky tree. It's also sort of meta-lucky that this event happened to a social scientist who was able to examine it intellectually and find meaning in it. That realization led him to hypothesize that people generally underestimate the role that luck has played in their lives. Quote, "Why do so many of us downplay luck in the face of compelling evidence of its importance?" he asks. The tendency may owe in part to the fact that by emphasizing talent and hard work to the exclusion of other factors, successful people reinforce their claim to the money they've earned, end quote. In other words, people who achieve or inherit a high level of wealth and success are invested in the idea that they earned it. To quote Cal Hockley, Billy Zane's character in Titanic, "A real man makes his own luck." That's the kind of aphorism you only espouse if you are rich, lucky, and utterly ignorant of how lucky you are that you are rich. That belief allows us to feel like we have control over this big, dumb, scary world, that if we're smart and we work hard, we will be appropriately rewarded and everything will be fine. Conceding that a lot of this is just dumb luck, including, most significantly, embryo-related stuff that happened before we were even conscious beings, is to concede that there were other factors at play beyond our own incredibleness, and that we're maybe not as amazing as our lot in life would indicate. Frank wants us to understand that a person's journey to success actually begins long before it might appear to. Take Michael Jordan, who is generally regarded as the greatest basketball player who ever lived. LeBron's better. No one worked harder at anything than Jordan worked at basketball. His determination was unparalleled, his commitment to his craft was off the charts, his intensity and competitive drive are legendary. Thinking of Michael Jordan as a guy who didn't earn everything he got, all the championships, the MVPs, the accolades, seems ludicrous. And yet, Jordan is 6'6". He didn't achieve that height because he, like, worked really hard at being tall. He was also born in America to parents who supported and encouraged his passion. Those two facts make him lucky. If you take Jordan's exact personality, talent profile, and work ethic, and you put them in the body of a 5'2" tall goat herder in Bangladesh, he does not become Air Jordan 6-time NBA champion. Instead, he becomes the most intense and irritating Bangladeshi goat herder in history, who is constantly yelling at all the other goat herders for not being good enough at herding goats. In fact, forget about changing his height and birthplace. If Jordan had been born exactly the same person, but 75 years earlier, we likely never would have heard of him. Baseball players like Oscar Charleston, Cool Papa Bell, Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, and Buck O'Neill aren't often listed among the all-time greats because they were born into an era of segregation and denied the chance to play alongside Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. Were they less talented or less diligent? Obviously not. They were simply the victims of bad luck, born into a racist world that kept them out of the major leagues. Thinking of it this way, everyone who achieves anything, no matter how talented or driven, benefits in some way from chance. Some people, far too few, but some, understand this. Warren Buffett, who, as noted earlier, has pledged to give 99% of his wealth to charity, writes this on his givingpledge.org page.
My wealth has come from a combination of living in America, some lucky genes, and compound interest. Both my children and I won what I call the ovarian lottery. For starters, the odds against my 1930 birth taking place in the U.S. were at least 30-1. My being male and white also removed huge obstacles that a majority of Americans then faced.
Again, no one would dispute that Warren Buffett is a genius, but he is a rare genius indeed in that he happily acknowledges the many strokes of good fortune that facilitated his rise. Walking us through the history of Microsoft, Frank writes this.
Most of us would never have heard of Microsoft if any one of a long sequence of improbable events had not occurred. If Bill Gates had been born in 1945 rather than 1955, if his high school had not had a computer club with one of the first terminals that could offer instant feedback, if IBM had reached an agreement with Gary Kildall's digital research, or if Tim Patterson had been a more experienced negotiator, Gates almost certainly never would have succeeded on such a grand scale.
Now, the people and events he's referencing there are footnotes in the life of Bill Gates, early deals or non-deals, events that almost occurred but didn't, that at the time seemed of minuscule importance, but which nudged Gates's life along a slightly different path from the one he was on. They were, for him, lucky, utterly unrelated to his talent or hard work or anything else. Just the ping-pong balls of the universe bouncing randomly around and landing in an arrangement that benefited him as he launched his remarkable career. No one on earth would say that Bill Gates and Michael Jordan don't deserve what they have. They're geniuses. But Frank's point is this. It's okay to admit that part of what they have is due to luck. It doesn't diminish their achievements. It simply acknowledges that we all owe part of our success to chance, and it celebrates those who were smart and capable and talented enough to capitalize on the breaks that go their way. And as we move around the world, bumping into people and interacting with them in a million big and small ways, that should give us a crucial perspective on their lives. The gods of luck demand tribute. I like to go to Las Vegas, maybe once a year. I play mostly low-stakes blackjack, $10 or $15 a hand, and I usually end up losing a couple $100. On the rare occasion where I end my trip in the black, up $100 or something, I feel nervous and unhappy. Why? Because I consider myself to be among the very luckiest people on earth. So when I lose $150 playing actual games of chance, it makes sense. It's like a sacrifice I'm making to the gods of luck to thank them for the million-to-one slot machine jackpot that helped get me where I am. The simple fact that I can afford to lose a couple $100 in a casino without it affecting my life at all means that I'm probably in the top 10th of 1% of all people on Earth, luckwise. I work hard, and I think I'm good at what I do, but consider the following facts of my life. Fact number one. I stayed home sick from school one day, and my mom rented me the movie Sleeper, which caused me to fall in love with comedy. Fact number two. I got into Harvard, through hard work, certainly, but Harvard had the Lampoon magazine, which had been churning out professional comedy writers for decades before I got there and joined the staff, which meant that when I graduated, fact number three, I had friends working at Saturday Night Live who agreed to help me submit a packet of material, which led to me getting hired there, and when I did, fact number four, I sucked at writing sketches for a full year. This is not false modesty. I was bad. My sketches bombed very hard at the table reads, and by any rational measure, I should have been fired. Except that, fact number five, right before I got hired, there was a big staff shakeup because an NBC executive had fired Norm Macdonald for making too many jokes about O.J. Simpson, who was a friend of the executive in question. Now, this was a true rarity for SNL to have NBC executives weighing in on staff decisions. Plus, 3 weeks before I got hired, Chris Farley had tragically died of a drug overdose, and he was being mourned by the show and the whole country. And those two events had thrown the entire SNL ecosystem into turmoil. So basically, fact number six, nobody even noticed I was there. No one paid attention to the new guy who sucked, granting me crucial time to figure out how to do the job, which I eventually did. After a couple of years, my friend Robert, who had been producing the Weekend Update segment, left to take a job in Los Angeles, and I was appointed to replace him because there weren't that many other people who either wanted the job or were that much more qualified than I was. So, fact number seven, I began producing Weekend Update, which at the time was hosted by Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon, who were so good at what they did and had such excellent comedic chemistry that the segment became incredibly popular, arguably as popular as that segment had ever been. After 3 years, my girlfriend and I decided to move in together, and she lived in Los Angeles, so even though I had a really good job, it made more sense for me to move there, where there are more writing jobs, than it did for her to move to New York. I arrived in LA at the exact moment that, fact number eight, Greg Daniels had decided to adapt the British show The Office for American TV and was looking for writers. Because Greg is so thorough and hardworking, he read something like 500 sample scripts in order to hire his small writing staff, including my sample, which he liked. The Office was a highly risky endeavor, and NBC had only picked it up for 6 episodes. That's a very small commitment, showing little faith in the show's long-term prospects, and I was potentially getting another offer from a show that had a 13-episode order, which is obviously a safer bet with more than twice the guaranteed salary. But the night before that meeting, I had insomnia, which is very rare for me. And when I met the producers, I was miserably tired and boring and low energy, and they didn't offer me a job. So when Greg did offer me the job, I took it. And, fact number nine, Greg turned out to be the greatest mentor and teacher in all of show business, walking me and the other very green writers on the staff through the process of creating and executing stories step by step, which most people in his position don't do because it's such painstaking work. So, I learned how to write half-hour comedy from a true master of the form. Everybody needs a teacher. And then we made 6 episodes of The Office, and it debuted on NBC in 2005, and, fact number 10, everyone hated it. The ratings were terrible. It had no chance to get picked up for a second season. Except that the executive in charge of NBC at the time, Kevin Reilly, deeply believed in it, and he decided to essentially risk his entire career on its success. Again, not something executives normally do. In the interim, meanwhile, Steve Carell had done a movie called The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which had been a wild and unexpected success, so NBC thought to themselves, all right, fine, we have this movie star under contract, we might as well give this show another shot. When we came back for season 2, fact number 11, the ratings massively increased, in part because, fact number 12, our time slot followed a new show called My Name is Earl, which was very popular right out of the gate, and in those days, people would just kind of leave their TVs on and passively watch things that came on after things that they had chosen to watch. So more people started sampling The Office, and they came to enjoy it, thanks in large part to some very smart creative decisions that Greg had made between seasons. The show took off, it became an enormous hit, which led to, fact number 13, Greg asking me to develop a new show with him. Because NBC was so desperate to capitalize on its success with another Greg Daniels show, they said that he could do whatever he wanted, really, and they would guarantee that it would get a full season commitment. That's something that's very common now, but it was an extreme rarity for the time. So he and I developed Parks and Recreation, but we had no idea who could play the lead role until, fact number 14, Amy Poehler decided to leave Saturday Night Live, where she had just finished a multi-year run as one of the most talented and beloved cast members in that show's history. So we asked her to do it, and she said yes, which meant that, fact number 15, the first show I ever created, A, had Greg Daniels as my mentor and partner, B, had Amy Poehler as the star and creative partner, and C, was guaranteed a full season on the air to find its sea legs. And yet, it only barely survived, because we didn't really write it very well in the first few episodes, and we didn't figure out how to create a character that played to Amy's strengths until the end of that first season. But we eventually did, and the show improved, and also, by the way, fact number 16, Chris Pratt was in the cast, mostly because, fact number 17, my wife JJ had worked with him on The OC, and she told me when we were casting it that he was otherworldly talented. And since he happened to be available, we scooped him up, and he turned out to be endlessly funny and wonderful, as did, fact number 18, all of the other people in the cast, like Rashida Jones, whom I had met on the second day of our freshman year in college and become friends with, and Nick Offerman, who would audition for a role